Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to evoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy.
Together, let us recite. In my service as a provider, I vow to respect the dignity and autonomy of my patients, guard their confidentiality, do them no harm, and be their partner in the journey toward health, to represent my field ethically and professionally, to provide high-quality evidence-based care with empathetic and humanistic intent, to care for patients without bias, including but not limited to age.
That was a snippet of 2023 Harvard Medical School graduates reciting their oath upon graduation. The Hippocratic Oath, named for a Greek physician who lived 2,500 years ago that some call the father of modern medicine, is one of the earliest examples of an expression of professional ethics. It is a symbol of a profession that has built in a number of protections for patient interests, with ethical and legal frameworks and requirements that seek to assure they are maintained. Today's guest thinks there should be a similar professional ethics framework in place for the developers of AI systems, and she's written a substantial paper on the why and the how of her proposal.
My name's Chinmayi Sharma, and I'm associate professor at Fordham Law School, and I'm really excited to join the podcast.
I am very excited to have you here. While I am talking to you in a virtual way today, I just had the opportunity to see you in person at an excellent symposium that you organized at Fordham. I think talking about it might be a way to describe what you get up to there. Tell a little bit about this event that you pulled together earlier in April.
Yeah, we were really excited that you could come. From a meta level, I think of events as opportunities to invite cool people that I fangirl a little bit, to bring them all in one room and then force them to be my friend in the long term. But facetiousness aside, it was an AI event because that's what we do today. We have AI events, but it was at a law school. And so the focus of it was about legal frameworks around AI and specifically on standard setting. So we've talked a lot about what we want AI to accomplish and a lot of the regulation that exists as goals in terms of behavioral outputs or what we want AI to be in, like fairness, non-discriminatory, avoid certain like highly sensitive use case applications and things like that. But we don't talk about how does one implement it? Like, how do you measure progress towards that goal? And then how do you get to a place where you're improving progress towards that goal? And then, so this conversation is around who gets to set those standards and how do we go about setting those standards? And I brought together a bunch of legal academics from the US, the EU, and Canada, from a variety of different institutions, from law schools and also from engineering schools. So we had folks from Carnegie Mellon and Paris Telecom and Columbia's engineering school. And so we had a very, I thought, lively discussion between lawyers that said, these are the standards that we should have. And then engineers that were like, the NIST RMF is garbage and there's no substance to it. And so, you know, that was enjoyable. And then Justin, you joined us for what I thought was the most exciting part of the day, which was our tabletop exercise.
Not the most exciting part of the day because I was there, but I think because the exercise was so well put together.
Well, thank you. Your lively contribution definitely made it better, though. I think you've missed enough your calling as a product engineer. But we did a tabletop exercise because conferences can be boring and, you know, everyone loves games. And it's, you know, jokes aside, the way people learn best is when they're put through simulations. I feel like that's been found consistently across a lot of disciplines. So I thought, why not put all of the people who purportedly care a lot about building responsible AI in the position of being one of these companies that has all of the best intentions of building a very useful product and walking them through a series of decisions that they're going to have to make related to how that product is designed. So for example, do you put the model in a centralized server? Do you have it on the edge? So on the device itself, what are the trade-offs there? And then what are the implications of that decision? So then now something complicated happens and you have to respond to a law enforcement request for data based on your users, how do the earlier decisions related to the product's design impact what your obligations are under the law, how you ethically feel about what you have to do? And so just walking through the general day-to-day set of firestorms that being a company in this space probably is.
What was great about it is that everybody had assumed a role. And as you mentioned, I took on the role of an engineer or chief technology officer or something. So I was operating outside of my normal comfort zone, but others were doing the same, including people who had a great deal of experience in some roles, playing the kind of flip side of their role in a trust and safety type position or in a journalistic position or what have you. It was also, there were individuals who were regulators or assigned the role of regulators. So we had the FTC kind of hanging out. We had federal law enforcement sniffing around, all of those things in the process of the exercise. And a lot of interesting kind of points of, I suppose, argument about how to move forward and what's best to do. But I appreciated also that you brought in the kind of market pressures, which seem to drive a lot of the decision-making ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, and this is a shout out to Stephen Keltz, who's an AI ethics professor at Princeton and has done several of these tabletops in various forms for students in his class and classes across engineering schools and computer science undergraduate programs across the country. But one thing that I love that he does is introduce these market pressures of, you might have come collectively to the recommendation that this is how the product should be built. And then the next stage of the tabletop, we say, the board is more concerned about their competitor having released this and they want to keep up with that. And they're concerned about their investors. And so they decided to go the opposite way. And so you not only have to deal with the fact that the market over trumped the maybe ethical and technologically informed decision you made, but also one person at the end of the tabletop brought up how demoralizing it was to have spent all of this time kind of getting to consensus on a decision and then just being told in the next round, everybody ignored what you said, which is the reality of being in one of these companies. You actually are probably going to be demoralized in that way more often than not. So it was fun to watch.
Well, an excellent exercise. And I don't know if you'll publish the exercise itself or if folks can have some way to take and use it in some other context, but I would definitely recommend that you do so if you're not planning to.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe an amazing venue like Tech Policy Press will want to share a readout of it. But no, we are hoping to, at the end of each round, we ask teams to just take quick, even as chaotic notes on how the decision-making process went and what they thought about. And hopefully we can synthesize those into some interesting takeaways. And yeah, I think that kind of explaining the background of the scenario, which for those listening, it was an AI personal assistant, which in many times a day, I think about how useful it would be if I didn't have to deal with coordinating two different calendars to find a meeting time, finding a restaurant that's halfway between individuals, connecting various apps. What if my AI personal assistant could update my resume based on the trends that they're seeing on LinkedIn? And then you go through a tabletop where you're actually forced to make some of those decisions. And then you're like, oh, crap, all of these will have bad outcomes.
I would hope that we will get the opportunity to run that readout and maybe make it available to folks. I'll just admit to my listeners as well that in playing the role of a CTO, I think of a Silicon, actually, it was a Canadian firm, I suppose. But I was a kind of wannabe Silicon Valley CTO. So I kept thinking to myself, all the decisions you made, you actually made at Burning Man while you were on ayahuasca. Just keep that in mind as you go through it. I try to keep that character going throughout.
Yeah, you committed to the character. It was some real method acting.
So let's talk about this recent paper, which I think gets into some of the similar kind of landscape of ideas, but I think takes it up a notch away from this type of decisions that may happen in organizations and puts the onus more on people who build AI systems themselves. So got this thing, AI's Hippocratic Oath. When did you get started on this and what was your motivation to start out with it?
So it was at a conference that was actually a cybersecurity conference that happened in California, Sausalito in think March 2023. And I was sitting in a closed door discussion talking about trust and safety and the future of trust and safety. And the people in the room were represented major government agencies, had either were at or were formerly at major tech companies. And we're talking about, on one hand, how important trust and safety is, and on the other hand, how impossible it is for regulators to come up with standards that are ubiquitously applicable, are comprehensive, that are not rigid, and that can innovate over time as technology advances. And they kept talking about things like ethics and standards of practice. And I just kept thinking about the approximately 437 members of my family who are physicians that talk about the same thing, that they're held to standards of codes of conduct and standards of practice. And for them, it falls under the big umbrella of malpractice. And there are a lot of criticisms individuals might have about physicians and the healthcare system overall. But I think it is hard to say with a straight face that doctors are not influenced in their day-to-day decisions by the standards of practice that they are held against and the threat of malpractice, which started me thinking, why don't we actually hold AI engineers to the same standard? Why don't we treat AI engineers the way we treat doctors? And the benefits I saw was not actually just to kind of scare AI engineers. It's actually more to just scare the employers of AI engineers into being more cautious. But it was actually, what if AI engineers had the opportunity to get together and develop their own standards of care? And this is something that technologists, it's my joke and say it's an anarchist world. It's not, it's a libertarian world in that they're like, kind of let me do what I want to do. But we're also talking about an extremely collaborative world of a lot of open sharing of communication and trying to get to consensus, but also breaking out into really valid schools of thought. For example, which Linux instance are you most into? Are you Ubuntu or Debian? And you have these kinds of like cults within the world, but still a community where people contribute to open source projects, where they want to help each other, where you post on Stack Overflow when you have a problem. And so I thought, this is a community that's already used to working together to solve problems. So what if we task them with the job of, hey, how do you, in a concrete, implementable, and measurable way, make AI safer and higher quality? And then what if we held them accountable to those standards?
So I want to read just one little piece of this from the beginning, which I think kind of gets to the core of what you're proposing here. So you write, the existing scholarship proposes solutions that fall into two categories of interventions, substantive regulation and legal liability. In the absence of ideal market behavior, some call on government to take on the Sisyphean seeming task of regulating AI. But you go on to say that's probably problematic in a lot of different ways. The government may not be up to the task. These approaches, these interventions may be insufficient, you say, on their own to tackle the intractable AI problem. Professionalization is up to the task. So let me ask you this. What do you mean in this context by professionalization? And I think most of my listeners know about the Hippocratic Oath, know about this language that essentially doctors commit to or are meant to commit to when they take on the practice. But how would that work for engineers in the context we're in?
I think that the useful comparison is just every other form of engineer. This actually already exists for civil engineers, electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, biotech, medical engineers. You go through engineering schools. You have a core curriculum of classes that you're supposed to take. You need to pass those classes. Some external professional body decides these are the classes you need to take. And that external body then evaluates for each school. Is each school teaching those classes in a rigorous enough way that we think that that meets our requirements? And then you graduate from that school. And then you take your fundamentals of engineering exam. So your first level of licensing. And that exam is designed by somebody in a professional association. And that's supposed to test your knowledge of, hey, before you start building stuff that all of us are going to use, did you really internalize and obtain any knowledge from this educational process that we force you to go through? And then after that, they can get a job. And that's like a certificate they can wave around and they could get hired based on that. And then once they're like, okay, well, I've enjoyed being a line engineer for a while, but I actually want to be the person that can stamp blueprints for approval. I can say like, actually, this is a product or this is a construction that I think is ready to be built. And then you take a different level of licensing exam and then you get past that. And then now all of a sudden you're the person that can stamp blueprints for approval, but then you're also going to be held accountable for that. And as an engineer, sure, you have your company that is supposed to tell you what to do. You have contracts to your direct clients that you have to comply with under contract theory. And you have kind of your general world of like products liability and negligence. But on top of that, you can be sued for malpractice. And where does this come into play? I am somebody that is renting a condo, and the condo was built by a developer. The developer hired the engineering firm. So a property developer is the one who's the direct client. They have a contractual relationship with the engineering firm. I don't have a relationship with the engineering firm. Say the engineering firm cut corners. They wanted cheaper materials. They did something else irresponsible. I, even though I have no relationship to this engineering firm, but I am living in the building that they were supposed to build, I can sue that firm for malpractice. That's the malpractice advantage, which is an ability for third-party individuals that are impacted by what a professional does to sue. And so what I mean by professionalization is let's take AI engineers and make sure that they have the requisite amount of training that we think that they should get. Let's make sure that they actually learned it. They didn't just sleep through classes and not. Everyone sleeps through class every now and then, but just not too much that they didn't learn anything at all. And that once they're in the field, if they do something irresponsible, that they are personally held accountable for that decision or that behavior. So that when you do that, like if it's a severe enough or consistent enough issue, you get kicked out of the profession. And we don't want people in the field that are going to consistently make these kinds of irresponsible decisions. And so that's not what I mean by professionalization.
So we're saying that the harms from AI are caused by irresponsible engineers, first and foremost. I like this idea at first glance. And yet I think to myself, in practice, for the last 30 or 40 years, we've behaved very differently. We've allowed Silicon Valley companies, individual technologists, anybody in the world can get on the internet and start running a massive social engineering experiment with no certification, no control groups, no consideration for a possible impact on individuals or society necessarily, within obviously some bounds that are mostly set by government. But I don't know, this seems so far away from where we're at the moment. How do you propose we get to where you're describing?
It's a great question. My answer is probably unsatisfying, but a slight correction on what you said earlier, because I have been accused of being very finger pointy in my writing, which is totally fair. I am very finger pointy in my writing, but I don't think that AI is harmful only because of irresponsible engineers. I think that some of the errors, some of the technical or ethical errors are made by people who are genuinely irresponsible, but some of them are made by engineers that are just doing what they're told and have no ability to push back. I mean, today, if you're an engineer on a team and you're told a particular feature that you have to build out, you can, and we see plenty of examples of this, of ethical questions that employees have about what their employers are doing, raising complaints about it and bringing that issue to their employer's attention. And then nobody pays attention to that. And they bring it to the public's attention and then they get fired. I think that there are some absolutely well-intentioned, totally competent. engineers that could be making harmful things, but not in a way that I think hold them accountable for it. But so how do we get there? My realistic answer, I think we're very far from it. And I think you're totally right. And I think that's because as a industry, tech, and now AI more than ever, is just the golden child of the market. And we have been so hesitant to impose any meaningful regulation in that field. And while I have hope that the growth of AI is going to mean that we will see more substantive regulation, I mean, I thought the executive order was a huge step in that direction, but still very limited in the scope of its mandates. I have some pessimism of whether we'll see that. if we were to take this seriously and do it, what this would mean is starting today to bring together a cross-disciplinary group of individuals to explore what it would look like to set a licensing board at the federal level, who we would want to be on it, how big we would want it to be, what conditions we would want for those individuals. For example, should it be AI engineers that are not working currently at a company to maintain some sort of kind of independence from market pressures? Do we want ethicists on it? Do we want civil justice individuals on it? Do we want lawyers on it? That kind of an exploration, so to eventually create under law that licensing body. And then that licensing body would have to develop, okay, what is AI? What falls under this? Do linear regressions fall under this? Are we only talking about generative AI? What is the scope of the authority that this licensing body would have? And then when we figure that out, do we have a tiered licensing system where people who just do sexy statistics can get a slightly simpler license, whereas people who are using kind of like generative AI for intelligence community purposes have to get a much more complicated or specialized set of licenses? I don't know, but that would be kind of the questions that we start to ask. And people tell me, like, this isn't going to happen overnight. And I'm like, but also the GDPR didn't happen overnight. We're still figuring out what we mean when we say we need GDPR compliance, right? But yeah, this would absolutely take at a minimum 5 to 10 years to really kind of get its heels in. But we have done it elsewhere. Air pilots and aerospace engineers are federally licensed. Nuclear engineers are federally licensed. Those are relatively new industries, and that happened relatively recently. It's not like, you know, it happens hundreds of years ago.
One of the things I like here is that you talk about prioritizing the public interest. You write, ultimately, all the different voices in the AI debate want the same thing, safe and socially beneficial AI. I hope that's true. I'm not entirely sure. However, today's companies aren't incentivized to serve the public interest. Professionalizing AI engineers can overcome this market failure by imposing an affirmative duty on AI engineers to protect society's welfare. How do you think about the relationship between these ideas and the quote-unquote market? What are you proposing here? Is this a, do you think of it as a market-friendly solution? Do you think of it as coming from someplace else? What's the political project here?
Great question. Is it a market-friendly solution? Kind of. I argue, more so than a lot of the other proposals I'm seeing, like licensing companies or licensing products, in that market friendly, I'm saying give every engineer that piece of paper with a stamp of approval on it that they are not forced to go to the OpenAIs or the Microsofts or the Googles, that they can take that paper and go to a venture capitalist firm and say, I have an idea and this is evidence that I'm qualified and that I am legally obligated to comply with certain standards. So that'll decrease your liability exposure for investing in me. Whereas if you license companies, every engineer, like the number of people that go into these fields is increasing hundreds fold each year. All of them are going to go to the same 5 companies. And that's what happens when you license companies. And when you license products, we've heard a lot of people talk about, I think that the compliance process for licensing products also means functionally, you're going to get the same thing if the same 5 companies are the only ones that can afford to go through that. But then on top of that, when you have a product in front of you that you are evaluating for approval, there's always a bias towards wanting to approve it because you have already seen it. And that, like, the fact that it already exists alone means that we might be getting products approved that should never have existed in the first place because we can't imagine the alternative. So anyway, is this market friendly? I think so in that way. Another way I think it's market friendly is I'm saying that let's have the engineers set their own standards. So you avoid the use of substantive regulation to put either extremely onerous and innovation limiting regulations down or just totally missing the mark. I believe that Tim Wu wrote this article a while back about how if we don't pump the brakes on these efforts to regulate, we might end up with not just ineffective regulation, but harmful regulation. I do trust if you take an engineer and you put them in a room with a bunch of other engineers that they'll come up with a pretty good technical solution for a problem if they're properly incentivized. And then how do I think this addresses the market failure? I think the Clearview AI example that my paper talks about is a perfect one. Facial recognition technology, Google and several other companies had fully developed that and had been sitting on it for years. And the reason they didn't publicly release it is because they were concerned about the massive privacy and ethical harms. They thought it was too dangerous for the public to use. ClearView AI comes along, an individual who does not have any particularly specialized AI experience that took open source tools and openly available research information to build a facial recognition technology that now everyone from Madison Square Garden to law enforcement to the intelligence community are relying on day to day. The minute they released that to the public, Google was like, shrug. Like, if they're doing it, then that barrier has already been broken. Now, the only thing that we have to think about is our market incentives. So it's like when you've breached that limit, the only thing left to wonder is like, now, do I have profit to gain by also adding a product to the space? And now we see there's a huge growth of the facial recognition marketplace where before, even though it was technically possible, companies themselves imposed an ethical barrier there.
And a lot of people would argue that the race you're describing with regard to facial recognition, exactly what we're seeing with generative AI at the moment, a lot of companies that essentially are rushing things to market despite, in many cases, obvious flaws that are causing them lots of reputational damage, at least in the short term. But I guess let me probe this a little bit just to make sure I understand your thinking on it, because what you're describing with the ClearView example is partly what I want to just query a little more about your approach here, which is that to your point about like building standards or civil engineering or maybe even accountants or medical professionals for that matter. If I want to become a doctor, there is a whole process I have to go through, right? I've got to go to medical school and get a degree and eventually get a license from the state in order to operate. If I want to build a condo, I've got to do all kinds of different stuff to get hold of the capital and the land and the permits and the rest of that. But the difference with software engineering is all I need is a laptop and an internet connection. So I don't know, how do you stop bad behavior in the same way in this environment where there are literally almost no barriers to entry apart from perhaps someone can come and sever your connection to the internet?
Yeah, no, there are some big implementation questions that I am not going to be narrow-minded and in defense of my proposal that I'm like, no, it's totally easy and it'll be a seamless implementation process. There are going to be some hard questions. I think that today, nothing is stopping me from taking, you know, a chef's knife and some WebMD knowledge and being like, I can totally take your appendix out. I've read a lot about it, but that would be the unauthorized practice of medicine. Now, why does that not happen? To be clear, it does happen. And there's still a big black market of medical services because our healthcare industry is so egregiously expensive. That's a separate issue. That still happens, but the reason it's limited is because there's social norms here and there's the interpersonal relationships of you have to face a client and you have a community set of reputations around a person. With the internet, that's different. I can sit behind my computer and no one may ever know that I am the individual that released this particularly harmful product into the world. So I agree, that is a really challenging issue. I think that what makes me feel that this is not a totally far-fetched idea is that we have a lot of choke points available to us to use. Because AI is so resource intensive, it is actually quite hard to go completely under the radar as the developer of a powerful AI technology. It's like a different question if you take a technology and then you implement, put a GUI on it and release it to the public. What I'm talking about is when you build the core AI product that is then commercially released, you need a large amount of computing resources. That's why we see some federal regulation and international regulation that's suggesting that we would track GPUs so that we know who's buying them up and who's using them for what. That's a choke point. That's an area where we're saying, okay, here's a way this is a proxy for us figuring out who's really active in this space. Another choke point you have is the employers. If you have a really talented individual, they're probably going to go to one of the companies. Which is why if you force people to get licensed, companies are going to be entities that want to enforce this themselves because they're going to want to hire people with licenses to minimize their liability exposure. They're probably going to be the ones paying for insurance for those employees. So they don't want to pay out. So they are going to also have internal checks to make sure that their employees are not flouting industry standards. So that's like a different choke point. On top of that, you have venture funding. So you're seeing already now with privacy and HIPAA, like there is a risk averseness in the tech funding world that there wasn't, I think, 10 to 15 years ago. So that is another area where you might say, before we consider this merger, before we consider this asset acquisition, I would like to see documentation of your up-to-date licenses and you're in good standing, et cetera, et cetera. And then on top of that, insurance. You might have an insurance regime that crops up around this. And that's going to be a different form of checks to make sure that if I, as a company, want to create a product and I'm worried about lawsuits, I'll probably want to get insurance. And insurance will make sure that I have licenses. Otherwise, they're not going to insure me.
What you're describing here in this paper is not something we start tomorrow and then we got this new regime in place. You're talking about a decades-long project, similar to the creation and implementation of accounting standards over a period of decades, as we observe financial crises, as we observe other kind of catalyzing events, we create institutions, we create certifications, and eventually we get to a place where maybe there's fewer Enrons or what have you. But what are the different institutions that you think will be necessary to leverage across that decades-long project to make this happen?
We have some professional associations today in the engineering world. Those are definitely institutions you want to involve. The ACM, the Trust and Safety Professionals Association. I'm absolutely not going to remember the full name, but there is a national kind of board of engineering that does the engineering licensing and exam design and things like that for civil, electrical, like other kinds of engineers. They actually have advocated in the past for having a software engineer license, but the software community shut it down. But they would absolutely be stakeholders you want to involve here. NIST can absolutely be useful. I think that NIST is best used when it's used to do in-depth, high-level research about an industry, about an area generally, not when it does very, very, very narrow technical standards, at least in, I think, the AI or software space. I think the criticism that NIST is getting for the RMF is, I mean, what else was it going to do? How do you come up with a risk management framework for all of AI everywhere? That's basically, they got the common denominator of general ideas. But anyway, so I think NIST could be a great partner there. I think you would need a federal licensing body. And so that would be something that needs to be created under statute. So you would need to get Congress on board. And then beyond that, you would want kind of advisory from right now, like for example, in cybersecurity, CISA has been doing an amazing job with limited resources and it's getting more. And I'm really glad to see that, of doing information sharing and having kind of your sector-specific agencies be in charge of the critical infrastructure protection with the knowledge that they have for their sector. For example, CISA can't be an expert in nuclear reactors, but it can lean on that agency to say, okay, CISA, we care about critical infrastructure protection and cybersecurity, but you guys have the expertise about nuclear technology. Let's bring this together in a way that can ensure that infrastructure is secured. Similarly, we should be using the agencies that exist in different sectors as a part of this process. For example, you'd absolutely want the FDA to be involved for medical device AI. And so I think that those are kind of just rattling off my head. And then also, you'd want to talk about international harmonization. The reason kind of medical licenses work is because jurisdictionally, it's clear when one doctor is treating one patient. But for AI, it's a much more complicated international ecosystem. And there is a very difficult question on, so what if we do licensing for AI engineers, if the EU, India, the UAE can just build whatever they want without licenses? How do we deal with that? Do we just say, we're going to double down on the era of firewalls and say that no foreign developed AI can be allowed into the country? We're already seeing today a lot of conversation about kicking an entire platform out of a country. That would be unprecedented.
I do think those national security dimensions are complicated with this, because there seems to be the idea among many leaders, not just industry ones, but obviously ones in government here and elsewhere, that regard AI as the ultimate advantage. If I get to AGI first, then we win. Our hegemony will be secured through the remainder of the century, et cetera. And that's almost trumps the public interest. It's almost like if a few folks get hurt because of biased algorithms along the way, that was all right because we beat the Chinese. And that almost seems to be the kind of mentality that you hear coming out of the mouths of certain people in this country, including ones who serve in the U.S. Senate.
100%. I was jokingly called by classmates in law school a deep state sympathist because I like cybersecurity and national security overlap quite a bit. And I don't know that I deserve that name, but I do think that individuals who spend every day fielding information about threats against the country's security are obviously going to be scared in the middle of the night about existential doom and be less concerned about something like the privacy of my online photos of dogs and cats. I think that bias is always going to exist. And I don't mean to discount that because we don't have the information about the threats against our national security. That being said, this is the year that like Oppenheimer came out. I think that how many times do we go through the story of if we can only do X, we'll finally be the leader, the undisputed leader, and then everything will be resolved because we, the good guys, will have control over this technology and everything will be fine. It's never worked in the past. There's countless both fiction and nonfiction books that talk about the use and advancements of science to gain geopolitical power and how bad that goes because geopolitical power is naturally inflammatory. Like you get it. And that's that there's no bigger incentive for a competitor to get it than being crap. We got to catch up and then pass these guys. So I don't know that getting to AGI first is the thing that resolves the national security concerns. But I also don't think there's going to be any way to convince the government that's not the way to address the national security concerns. It feels like you're watching the train wreck happen and there's nothing you can do about it.
Perhaps we'll come back to that difficult question another time, but I do want to ask you another question about your proposal here, which you do point out this idea that there are risks to professionalization. You kind of can create a scenario where certain ideas or certain methods or certain maybe approaches might get pushed out because the professional class regard them as anathema to their assumed knowledge in the space. And I think we've seen that in medicine, right? We've seen it with various alternative medicine approaches or like traditional medicine approaches, which do have
homeopathy.
Yeah, but they're pushed out entirely. And I'm not, my listeners, don't think that I'm necessarily in all cases siding with the folks who are selling you supplements or what have you. But, you know, there are clearly ideas that they've come from older cultures that we've discarded because they're not scientific enough or what have you. How do we avoid that in this or some corollary to that?
No, I love that question. As an Indian American immigrant, I grew up with my mom forcing me all throughout the winter to drink turmeric milk and hating it with every fiber of my being. And then now people pay $8.50 for golden lattes because now we have in Western society just gotten smart to the fact that turmeric is really healthy for you, where Indians have forced their kids to drink it for like thousands of years. But yes, I think there's the great New York Times article that came out earlier this year about how maternal mortality in childbirth skyrocketed. And the reason this happened is because the medical community pushed midwives out. And because midwives were pushed out of the process of childbirth, the medical community did not care about maternal health in the same way. The mom did not have an advocate there in the room that was only there for her being and to facilitate the childbirth process. That kind of generational knowledge that gets passed down in the tradition of midwiving was lost. And so I think that is the hubris of professionalism that's really dangerous. And that costs lots of lives. It's really bad. So you're like, okay, how could you possibly be on board with professionalization then? I think it's because I optimistically think you can learn from lessons of the past and redesign a professionalization regime that accounts for that. I think part of why that you're seeing a lot of harmful to patients and anti-competitive practices in the medical industry is because state licensing boards are in many cases just functionally cartel. And there's been a lot of really great legal scholarship being written about this, where the best to do in their fields, get appointed by the state to these licensing boards. In the classic case of if you have money and you donate to politicians enough, then naturally you're going to get appointed to powerful positions. Then you get into these licensing boards. And if you're in charge of setting the standard of care, it most benefits you to set a lower standard of care because then you're going to be liable for less as somebody who is still in the field. People on these licensing boards, they're still actively practicing medicine. So they're making rules that are going to bind them. So you obviously know that there's a conflict of interest there. It's also like an old boys club, maybe not in the same way that we always used to think of, but that's the protectionism of I want to take care of my own exists. And so then you have people that refuse to testify in court against their colleagues. We call it the conspiracy of silence. Theoretically, these boards are also supposed to have lay people on them, aka not professionals. And by statute, they're required to have them. But basically, those are appointed with any real intentionality. It's just like, you know, somebody's grandpa is appointed to this board, never shows up for anything, doesn't really even have voting power. So obviously, that's not doing anything. But what if instead there wasn't a vast majority of actively practicing AI engineers on the board? What if you also had some of the individuals that are like the largest opponents of AI also sitting on these boards, and there needs to be consensus found between these parties? And so you truly have that kind of cross-disciplinary approach. Like maybe at that point, you have enough of the public stake as a part of the conversation that you keep in check the hubris and massive blind spots of just one industry. Like any one industry is going to have hubris and massive blind spots, which is why I think every single policy proposal will have cross-disciplinary and multi-stakeholder at some part of the document or press release about it. But it's true. Those are really important.
I want to ask you maybe a last question about, are there other frameworks that you considered in this as well? One that's been suggested to me over the years that might also do some of the things that you're trying to accomplish here is the kind of ethical principles for protection of human subjects research, the ethical principles that came out of the Belmont report, you know, these ideas around beneficence and the boundaries between practice and research and other kind of ideas around justice and how to do that with human subjects. Are there other frameworks that you think could be useful here?
Yeah, just a shout out a former student who is awesome. Amy Nishimura wrote an article about whether or not human subject review regulation should apply to the U.S. government, or specifically the military, using deep fake generation technology, and whether the fact that those are trained on photos of real individuals and voices of real individuals requires them to go through human subject review. She published on Lawfare. You should check out the article. It's awesome. But I think that what I'm advocating for is totally compatible with tort litigation and substantive regulations. If we want an omnibus federal AI act, I think that we should be very thoughtful about it. But I'm not saying that that's incompatible with professionalization. We have lots of federal statutes that govern what doctors can and cannot do. For example, we have a federal statute that says if I patent a life-saving surgical technique, I cannot enforce that patent against other doctors. You have to allow other doctors and hospitals to use that surgery. You can't make money off of it. And that's huge. That was an amazing thing for the medical field. But two things that one, AI Now as an organization has put out great work on this, and I think that they continue to do work on this. I think labor is an entire world of frameworks. That would be really powerful here. I talk about professionalization as a way to empower engineers, but what if you unionize them? What if you gave them collective bargaining rights? What if you gave them the ability to have a real seat at the decision-making table and were not totally held to the whims of executives that are more beholden to their investors than they are to the public interest? So I think labor is absolutely something to explore here. And another area is, I write about this in the cybersecurity context, but products liability. What I'm talking about is from day one, before we even started building the project, or long after we built the product and we're maintaining the product, there's a lot of engineer practices that could be irresponsible, but are very hard to litigate in tort law. And so that's where I think professionalization could be really useful. Be really thoughtful about how you curate training data. Be sure you document your practices and don't just bullshit your documentation. But you still, I think product liability has a big role to play here. These AI tools are products and we should hold them accountable for defects that ultimately cause harm. So I think that's another area that we should really think through how we want product liability to apply to these technologies.
This paper concludes by suggesting that professionalization would divorce the interests of individual engineers from the corporate incentives driving our current AI race to the bottom and imbue them with social responsibility. A worthy goal, and I would commend my listeners to go and check this paper out. It's called AI's Hippocratic Oath. Chinmayee Sharma, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guest, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.